Good afternoon. Actually, it's evening. Good afternoon. My name is Veronica Entwistle, and you have tuned into Paradigm Shifters. What is a paradigm shifter? Someone who's making a difference and sending a wave of change and evolution through the collective of our species on the planet. I have a very, very exciting, wonderful paradigm shifter today named Rowena Patty Crider. And got in front of me a book you've written, Rowena, called The Golden Echo. So welcome to the show.
I'm delighted.
I'm delighted, too. And this Golden Echo, The Life and Art of Rowena Patty Crider, it chronologues your evolution from your very early years, actually. It's a very exciting book, bringing in pictures of your art and the activities that took you shamanically through an awful lot of awakening. I don't know quite where to start, except I want to start at source. How did you first contact the concept of discovering source through your own beingness?
Well, I don't think it was any one time. I've been blessed with a very early age of just living that way.
But you've known
it. It sounds strange, but, you know, as a child, I just loved nature and art. Those were the two words I capitalized. Mm-hmm. And the teacher always made it wrong, but I kept capitalizing them. And it's because there was beauty and joy there.
Hmm. And you knew that you were resonating with some kind of power there, I think.
Well, yeah, you just naturally, you know, as a child or as an even an infant, you know, people naturally want. And in fact, I feel ecstasy or joy or bliss, what Joseph Campbell called bliss, you know, mm-hmm. is an essential. It's not just an extra of human life, it's essential.
Mm-hmm. And you were actually not a rambunctious child, you were just a really deep, artistic child, right?
Well, I was rambunctious, too. I used to jump out of trees with my mother's slip for parachutes and, you know, a lot of different things.
Now, did you actually fly?
Well, I would say that her slips helped a little bit, but it knocked the wind out of
me. And so when we talked about it, you had a... it's very interesting how children cope with these things, because you had a really deep kind of a knowing about an ongoing spiritual process, did you not? It seems like that's right in your work.
Yes, I wouldn't have talked about it, certainly, but it's been continuous. I don't mean that I haven't fallen on my face in a lot of different experiences and so forth, but I've had the good fortune to know the difference, you know, to know when I'm on and when I'm not. And so, you know, you just keep coming back to source. And it is really, as you say, sourcing. Mm-hmm. And people are generally in our society taught to affect rather than source. Mm-hmm. In other words, to make an impression, to get paid, to get have a goal, to get results, instead of sourcing, which is, you might say, looking the other way, which is where the ecstasy is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could see that a manager of a production company of some sort wouldn't want all of his teammates to be sourcing while they're trying to get something done. So, you know, there's some, you could say problems with it, but there isn't really any problems with it for people's personal unfoldment.
That's interesting. So when did you start, let me see, I've got a bunch of focuses I want to bring in, and one of them is your connection to sound, light, and color. And when I'm reading a description of a workshop you're going to be doing in Santa Cruz, there's a term here called the love light becoming matrix mind and
etheric. Yeah. Ether
energy is a fundamental polarity, and these in turn interact with what physics calls the vacuum. Far from empty, holds the potential seed patterns for all of creation. And I notice as I'm going through your book, your art in these various phases is really deep and rich and pulling through amazing symbols. I'm going, okay, let's talk about symbolism and how it started coming up when you were very small. And when did you connect sound and
Well, sound and color, I can't remember when that wasn't, you know, because that's universal language, everyone to some degree, but I guess I had, you know, special sensitivity. I don't know if it was special. There's no reason why everyone can't.
Well, it's called
enjoy
right?
the, you know, color, but I've never had a period when I didn't do art. I mean, since I was 2 or 3. So there's never been a period when I didn't do art. It wasn't something that, you know, I decided one day to do. It's just like brushing your teeth or eating. It's part of daily process. But symbolism didn't really come in immediately. Symbolism takes a certain level of soul development, I think, where you get involved in the invisible, the unconscious, the deeps, that you're a little more conscious of the unconscious.
So that's when you started with your with meditation groups and studying
with
various teachers?
Yeah, right. It was in my 20s that I got into symbolism. So I had a period from 1966 to 74 where I studied myths and symbols very deeply. It was like going through a tunnel. I didn't know if I'd ever emerge. Because I was asking, where is humanity going? I mean, what's the meaning of life? And what's the source? And what's the point of it all? And so forth.
And I'd like to say that what I read here was how when you studied with Suzuki Roshi,
yes.
And you said, this is a quote from one page, and this is 63 time, or at least that's when you started studying with him.
Yes.
And then you said something, a line which I absolutely love, which is, Suzuki's open love activated the original codes that I carry.
Yeah.
Now, the original codes imply to me, you know, being an intuitive as well, that the message that my particular vibrational beingness brings to the planet, is that right? Or your unfoldment potential?
Yes, I mean, every person is unique as a soul, you could say. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm meaning by, you could say, the codes, the uniqueness of the soul. And so to fit in or to follow others or to mimic others or try to be accepted won't help.
Mm-hmm.
That soul, deep soul purpose. It's more actually following your joy that brings you there.
So the joy can direct us to our personal codes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it isn't always. Now, joy is not pleasure. There's a difference between joy and pleasure.
Is the joy
you can have by having a meal. It isn't. You can have joy even if you're in pain climbing Mount Everest. Do you see the difference?
Is it in the ecstasy?
Yes. When you're following your joy, people might call it other words, but you might go through all kinds of difficulty and training. You might even suffer. You might say it sounds like a contradiction, but to have that joy. Because your soul is aligned with you. Mm-hmm. I think when people are unhappy, their soul actually goes off, you could say, out of the personality, because the personality is to follow the soul, not the other way around.
Well, that's really interesting, because I learned a long time ago that when you're really deeply lonely, it means you're looking for your path or that which is truly you. So it's a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I just think, oh, that could mean that our souls have the gap's gotten too wide, you know.
Mm-hmm. So yes, when you're, I think suffering or unhappiness is when the personality, that it, by that I'm meaning the body, emotions, mind, are not in some way malleable by the soul. The soul is to be the master, the director. And it takes a long off. Well, I think children even know that. But then inevitably in teenage years or 20s, people, you know, wander around and their souls separate and they become miserable and suffer and so forth. So then you have to consciously learn to cultivate the personality to train it, really, kind of like training a wild animal. Train it to, you know, heal and sit, so to speak, or to actually follow the intrinsic joy that the soul knows. And it's, in a way, a dangerous course. That's why my life in the Golden Echo, as it demonstrates, is not exactly your status quo routine kind of life. I've been freelance artist, writer, meditator for 36 years entirely on my own. Mm. No social security, no, you know, usual kinds of support.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it works. And not only in terms of finances, it's not like I'm wealthy, but I manage. And but it very much works in terms of soul development.
Now, when you're doing soul development, for example, living into the soul, which is what I'm culling out of some of what you're saying,
yeah.
Would you say that we follow, I believe meditation is one of the roots that makes it more possible.
Yes.
But following the symbols that are uniquely your own, following it like a, treasuring that which really touches you in order to follow that, how would you say it works?
Yes. Yes, I think, you know, you learn ways that do help you cultivate without attachment, and yet, you know, I mean, we do treasure things, and yet there's always these paradoxes in the process where you come upon something and it's purely spontaneous and joyous, but then you want to, you know, possess it, and it's the possession that also causes suffering. In other words, trying to control the thing that otherwise came to you spontaneously.
Yeah, and to make it repeatable so you can
repeatable. Just like people in relationships, they have a delightful first encounter and then they try to possess each other, and that causes misery because you expect things of each other, and you're expecting something, you're projecting rather than trying to understand them. And so it's similar. It's that kind of manipulation and control that brings about misery.
And you had several marriages, right?
I had two, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very early. I mean, already those are 36 years. I mean, the last one was 36 years ago.
And did you find that whilst you were young when you were married,
yes,
right?
Yes, I was very young.
And did you find that you, what would I say? Did it limit your spiritual exploration to be in those relationships, or?
No, but not in a true sense. I married an Englishman in the first place. He's a very fine man, very tolerant and very intelligent. But I moved to Edinburgh, you know, at 19, hadn't a clue what being an English housefrau would mean, you know. Couldn't imagine that. You know, serving tea and darning socks the rest of my life. So I continued my art and he was very encouraging of that, and I was very appreciative of that. Art and poetry is what I did. And then I ran through the streets of Edinburgh rather wildly, because I wouldn't allow a convention to... contain me. And eventually the marriage simply fell apart because my spirit wasn't imprisoned, but it created friction in the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because I painted so much and ran around the street. I don't mean I ran around the streets in a promiscuous way. So I simply was letting off energy.
Oh, that's funny. Was he?
And the second one was an entirely different lesson. You know, you never, if you learn something, you never have to do it twice.
Right, okay.
So I mean, you know this, Veronica, as well as
I do.
It's just that you're the interviewer and I'm being interviewed.
I know, and I'm enjoying this so much.
Anyway, I did have marriages, and I learned a lot, and I'm grateful for them. But my inspiration, my sole purpose, my, you could even say destiny,
mm-hmm.
Was too strong for... Mm-hmm.
For the containment.
Yeah, the containment. It was just... And my second husband, unlike the first, was extremely possessive.
Hmm.
So he did try to stop me from even meeting with gray-haired old ladies. And he was very, very jealous.
And this wasn't in England anymore.
No, this was in Eugene, Oregon.
Hmm.
And anyway, he couldn't control me. It's not like I did a lot of devious things. That's when I went into myths and symbols.
Hmm.
I went deeply inward.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, when he was asleep, I was often either doing Zen meditation or studying world myths and symbols.
And did you ever sleep?
So I managed to discover a great deal on the inner planes. And that was in the 60s when everybody was hullabalooing with drugs. I never had drugs at all. I never had the opportunity even to go out, hardly.
Hmm. But you traveled like mad.
No, during that marriage, I didn't at all.
I mean inside.
Oh, yeah.
You traveled well.
Yeah, inwardly, I learned about different cultures, universal themes of mythology, universal symbolism, what different forms mean, and I don't mean just mentally. I mean on a deep level.
Mm-hmm. I can really appreciate that. I just want to go back into the personal just for a minute. You have two sons.
Yes. And
it's interesting. We have two, for example, that you have two husbands, and there was some stretching of the containment. Were the sons able to embody their own journey in this context as well, or was it the same problem?
Well, they very much did. The first son... let's see, I left before he was even two. I left Britain. And so I basically raised him on my own.
Hmm.
And he actually is more conventional than the other son. He's a scientist and a very good one, research. He does think for himself, has a great sense of humor, and is lots of fun. And on the other son is extremely creative. I'm not saying the first son isn't creative, but in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
And they are from the two different fathers. And the second son has created first of all, he has a PhD in modern Chinese literature history and speaks Mandarin.
Hmm.
But then he became a farmer.
Good for him.
You know, after so much academic stuff, he just wants to learn practical things.
Well, good
so
for him.
He made cheeses and sold them throughout the country. Very exotic French cheeses, mainly in the New Orleans area. And then, after 7 years, it started creating lodges and places for people to go to learn about natural foods and green energy and how nature relates to health and all, and lifestyle.
Hmm.
So they created the buildings. They do the cooking. It's all gourmet vegetarian.
Hmm.
And so he's doing that now in Nova Scotia. And three places.
Hmm.
One in Costa Rica, one in Nova Scotia, and one in Spain.
So he's got, both your boys have their own journey, though. I mean, I guess that's
very much so.
Yeah. There's no real stifling going on in your family that way.
No, but I'm, we probably needn't dwell further on that, but my second son's father is still trying to control his son, but he can't, and so he's eternally angry and frustrated. He still hasn't learned. So it's, he's trying to control him just as he did me. So
it's so interesting how human beings will resist that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, not everyone is like that. People do learn things and are willing to open up and surrender and change and be more malleable.
Maybe a lot of it has to do with the drives, our own personal codes again, aren't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's not always personal codes. I think a lot of it's conditioning. And there's a difference. Because some people go by their conditioning and the status quo and what people think. Mm-hmm. And other people do follow their codes. And they're too often entirely different things.
How can we find our codes? Can you recommend how we do that?
Follow your joy.
Even if it makes you cry, eh?
Yeah, one has to get in touch with the inner life.
Mm-hmm.
Without being in touch with the inner life, if you're in touch with the inner life, you feel happy, you feel supported, you feel the divine source loves you because you love the divine source. As we love, we are loved. And that's reciprocal and everything flows. On the contrary, if we're trying to get approval from somebody or some group, or and that you put all your stakes on getting that approval, you're almost inevitably going to suffer because it isn't going to happen consistently.
Well, those attachments keep your identity frozen too, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I mean, though, by conditioning. I'm not saying all conditioning's bad. I'm just saying there's a difference between conditioning and soul codes. And every soul is unique, and everyone needs to sing their own unique voice song so that the whole symphony of the universe has this harmony. Then we'll all be rejuvenated and lifted up. I do feel that even in my lifetime, and I'm not so young, we're going to begin creating a culture based on cosmic laws of harmony.
I'm glad that you're not so young, because what you've brought us are real awakenings to, for example, when a number of you went shamanic journeying together.
Yes.
And discovering a kind of, maybe you'd like to talk about that more than I would, but you're discovering a kind of not just compatibility, but a unity way deep in the subconscious.
Yeah.
Would you say it that way? Or maybe
yes, that's a good way. That's very perceptive. Because when we, I primarily did that in Mount Shasta, and also when I taught at the California Institute of Integral Studies. But anyway, when people do go deep together, journey, so to speak, to drumming, and go through ceremony, then often the journeys, the visualizations, or what occurs to people have points of similarity. Just as, like, groups that work closely together may have parts of dreams that are interconnected. So when the unconscious or the subconscious becomes more conscious in this kind of way,
mm-hmm.
you know, we come closer to what I call the love light.
And
that's
so,
the source.
And when you're talking about the potential evolution of our species fairly soon, I sort of go back to that and go, yeah, we can really touch each other and move consciousness at a group level, can't we?
We can. We can do it on a group level, not by organization, but by each person being in touch with their deep level, soul level codes.
That's what I love, is that root inside.
Yeah, if we don't have that within and somebody tries to take charge and control everybody else in that kind of group, it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be from the inside out.
And that is the root to human consciousness shift anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Be who
that
you really are.
A much of the paradigm shift.
And I have to say, you have some terrific lines in this book. Alchemical fermentation. Alchemical fermentation. Is that not a wonderful phrase?
Well, it's a process.
So what is it? Can you talk about that?
Well, alchemical fermentation is the fourth phase of seven alchemical stages, and it's like becoming aware of the essence of your soul, which alchemically might be called gold. And it's becoming aware of that and realizing that that has high priority. It's not put in the back burner. So one allows that to ferment, which means that it spreads throughout your being. It spreads in your life, in your daily life, in your relationship. In other words, it's the soul essence that is spreading in your life.
And when I think of fermentation, I think of a bubbling. So it's not just spreading, it's actually almost...
Well, it's kind of like yeast or bacteria, you know. Mm-hmm. It may be... It's not necessarily bubbling, but it is actually a spreading, because there's, you could say, reproduction going on and among, you know, yeast or bacteria. So, I mean, just as an analogy.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So there is a permeating quality to fermentation. And then that is followed by distillation, which is purifying the essences that have come up. The essences are what I've been talking about is joy. When you get in touch with that and you learn to stay consistent with it. Now that's the hard part, because people are not, I hesitate using the word discipline, but
just means teaching us, doesn't it?
Yeah, we need rhythms of practice in our life in order to make our way consistent, so we're not just a victim of every whim or different thought or different events that occur, and we're not reacting all of the time.
So how did you take charge of that in your history, in your world?
Well, frankly, I am most grateful to Zen for that. I mean, I had Zen in the midst of my most difficult marriage. And it was kind of like, well, I didn't have just Zen in the emptiness and no problems. I had extreme problems. And so I had something to work on.
The Zen of codependency?
Well, it wasn't codependency. It was dealing with an angry husband and seeking to not react myself. To learn to not react, no matter what's happening, even if he's angry all of the time, to not react. Let it be, you know, and not try to control him either. So anyway, then just sitting and breathing and going deep and letting all the stuff go was very, very profound. I did that for seven consistent years, and then I switched to Vipassana Buddhism, which has 10-day intensives. Zen has 7-day, but they're much stiffer, much more deep. You get up at 4 a.m. and you sit 40 hours, and then you walk in meditation for 10 minutes. You sit for another, it's like 14 meditation periods a day.
Oh, my. That's Zen, or is that Vipassana?
That's Zen.
Okay.
For 7 days. I tell you, that gives you a clean out. It's just designed for that.
So
I'm very grateful for... I don't mean that everybody needs to do that. I'm just saying, well, that in my life, that's what came along. And I was not looking for Zen. I was doing sumi painting in Point Reyes Peninsula in California, and I was just having a great time following my joy in painting, and I was told there was a sumi teacher at the Zen temple, and that's how I ended up meeting Suzuki Roshi.
And what's sumi painting?
Sumi painting, a Japanese brush or Chinese brush, black and white, monochrome landscape painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sumi ink is a black ink.
Hmm.
Is painting landscapes on rice paper.
So what happened when you were doing Zen? Did your art take a big shift?
Ooh, I don't know whether it did or not. No. What did take a big shift is that I had extreme kind of kundalini experiences.
Wonderful.
Well, yes and no. It's not so easy.
But it's joyful, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. And highly energetic.
Hmm.
And but I didn't sleep during that period for 2 months.
Oh, my.
At all. And that's not so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it was wonderfully intense.
Hmm. Did you do any art during that period?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. And I did a large sculpture, and I always do gardening, which is very grounding. I've also built houses. I love to do grounding kinds of things.
Hmm.
So I think that's very important that people stay practical and grounded and learn essential kind of practical skills and love nature. And
what kind of houses did you build? Were they?
Well, I built, one of them's in the book of this underground place called the Cave of Donnie in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
I resurrected a ruin, which was underground. And that was one of the biggest challenges of my life, too. But,
oh, that's an amazing series of pictures.
Yeah, so that was a very liberating, that was quite a bit after the Zen and the husbands, and but that was in the late 70s.
But, you know, when I was first asking about your art, I was looking back at the A Star of Resurrection. No, is it?
Yeah.
A wonderful picture. It's called The Star of Resurrection, 1968. It's quite smashing. And I was wondering if the sacred geometrics that you're obviously incorporating into your work at that point, where did they come from? Did they emerge in your consciousness exploring? Did they emerge?
Well, you could say that's part of the symbolism,
mm-hmm.
but geometry is one of my favorite things. And I think, you know, people as souls, as unique souls, have different histories. I don't only believe in past lives, but they're not even past, you know, but that we've all been around many, many times. And so I'm sure doing architecture, sacred geometry, that's all just very familiar to me.
Mm.
But the Star of Resurrection is actually on the theme of six different cultures. And their spiritual beliefs of resurrection.
Oh, I see. It's magnificent, actually.
As Chinese and Egyptian and Greek and so forth. So I was integrating cultures around common themes at that time. And yeah. Resurrection was one of the themes.
It's actually very wonderful. I feel like I want to pick your brains for all kinds of things. So this is a very, very beautiful building. Did you use sacred geometrics in the construction of it?
Which building? Are you talking about the
Cave of Dawning? Yes.
Yes. Well, it was just a ruin, you know.
Mm-hmm. I see the pictures of it.
It was abandoned for 14 years, and it was burnt in a fire 14 years before. And nobody wanted to deal with it, and so a realtor showed it to me, and I had not even enough money to buy the lot, but I managed to get a loan for $20,000, and I actually did all of the building.
Oh, you did?
Most of myself, along with two or three characters that I found from the unemployment office. The ones who could survive stayed, and most of them fell through the floorboards or disappeared.
Wow.
It was a very challenging time, but it was. I learned so much, and so that, yeah. Eventually, it was beautiful because I did mosaics on the walls, inside, and niches, and built placards and out in the gardens. And Santa Barbara, of course, is warm enough that you can have mosaics outside.
And the octagonal paths, this is very beautiful. It's just really outrageous. And then you got into... gatherings? That isn't where you started off your harmonics, creative harmonics?
No, creative harmonics started in Mount Shasta.
Okay.
Much later.
But the pictures I'm looking at now, this is you were having great ceremonies at this house, is
oh,
it?
Oh, sure. I've always done that. Had groups and creative groups where we do drama, poetry, music, art, you know, meditation, that kind of thing. I don't know when I haven't done that.
And then you got into mathematics and sacred geometrics. And
yes.
And here's a picture with you and Buckminster Fuller.
That was an individual thing. Mm-hmm. It's not something I did with groups. It's just something I enjoyed. Because you have insights about how the universe is structured that way. And I love, you know, I have a need for understanding. I don't mean that I ever can fully mm-hmm. understand the mysteries of the universe, but that's what I'm working on now, is this interconnection.
So I'm going to jump from that into this wonderful deck of vibrational healing cards,
mm-hmm.
which I've had for a few years, thanks to our mutual friend Randy Masters, who brought those up at a bookstore and said, oh, these are outrageous, and they really are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know which ones I'm talking
sure.
about.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what bookstore was that?
It was in Ashland, Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it was a few years back, maybe 3 years back.
Huh, is that all?
Hang on one sec, I'm just
going
to
they've been around since, I don't know, 97 or something.
Well, what's really interesting, you know, the reason I wanted to bring them here right now is partly because I have them and I want to show them off, but because you started... using symbols like that somewhere along the way. So if I turn up one of these cards and I sit and I stare at it, right?
Yeah.
Then it evokes something deep within, doesn't it?
It does. See, the geometries do have harmonic rhythms that can help balance and attune people, color and form and sound. Those are the languages, you know, that help... on these kinds of levels, nonverbal. And
what do they do, Rowena? Do they activate us?
Well, they activate, or they calm, or they balance, whatever is needed.
So I brought up genetic code, and the reason I'm bringing that up is just saying, so does that help me be in touch with, because we're always trying to change our DNA and so on these days, right?
Yes, on the other side is incorporation, and that's the newer side. There's old earth and newer sides to these cards. And the genetic code is getting in touch with your code lineage, your family, your ancestors,
mm-hmm.
and being grateful for, you know, the gifts that you have through that lineage. The genetic is totally different from the soul lineage. Now, people don't speak of soul lineage because, you know, science has sort of taken over and said, well, genetics and environment, that's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
But
a lot of us don't believe that.
What?
A lot of us don't believe that.
No. Mm-hmm. So each person has their soul calling, and that is, you know, a different kind of lineage. Anyway, genetic code does suggest getting in touch with ancestors and also, yes, I don't know about changing your DNA. I think our DNA can only be changed from what I call prime source. It, genetic engineers can manipulate genes and make combinations, but they can't upgrade because unless they actually have the upgrade.
But do you feel that you can go into your own body, mind, work with your essence and your higher concepts, and possibly work with the lineage that creates your physical structure at this time?
Yes, I think that's the whole point, is to go into that divine essence and work from the inside out.
And
that doesn't mean, you know, I'm not talking about consciously trying to change your DNA. If you live consistently in your divine essence, my sense is that Prime Source will change your DNA code accordingly.
And okay, that's good enough for me. It's wonderful. So, where did you bring up the symbolic presentations on these wonderful cards? Did you just bring them out of your meditation, or how did you get these?
It's not so easy. People always ask, well, how did you do that? But it's not so easy to say, because it's not like suddenly there's a revelation and you just copy it or something. I'm incessantly working creatively with different designs, processes, meditations, nature, images, all kinds of things, and they, every now and then there's a very deep insight of connection between one thing and another. And eventually, for example, all my divination decks, and there are four, all came through very quickly. But that's because I worked for years before on all the kinds of things that led up to it.
So none of this was unfamiliar to you?
No.
What about the meanings of them? Did that just flow through you intuitively as well? Or?
Well, yes and no. I can go into higher states of consciousness at will. I do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my, you know, that inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to write a text for a divination to help people, it needs to be in tune with what I call the invisible matrix. It's got to be in, otherwise they won't be pulling the right cards.
Mm.
It won't speak to them. And so it needs to be in tune with that universal matrix, that, and then it works as divination.
Hmm. Which is your favorite deck? You've done four?
Yes, right now I'm preferring the Co-Creation Code deck, but it's more recent.
Okay.
I started with the I Ching,
mm-hmm.
Moving with Change. That was in mid-80s, published by a British publisher. But the Gaia Matrix Oracle I taught in Mount Shasta for 10 years, and that was, that's a very big oracle. So vibrational healing cards are part of the Gaia Matrix Oracle.
Oh, I see. I've looked at some of the pictures of it, but, you know, I don't have the cards. I guess I can look them up.
Well, that people don't have to know that the vibrational healing cards are part of the Gaia Matrix Oracle,
mm-hmm.
but they are. They're the symbols in the Gaia Matrix Oracle made into three-dimensional color images and given reading, which I did in 1997. I wrote the text last.
Wow.
And I wrote the text... I use the word, the love light, in the vibrational healing cards a lot, because that's just a term for source. No,
I like it very much, actually.
Because if you say love, people mean all kinds of things by it, and you say light also, you know, it's hard to use words at all, really.
Well, they sort of freeze things, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what is your, you created the center that you have, right? Did you build
well,
it?
Well, I had a very powerful center in Mount Shasta for 12 years.
Hmm.
And that, I don't necessarily have a center exactly here.
Mm-hmm.
In I'm outside of Austin, Texas now.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Mount Shasta... I had 82 acres and five buildings, and people, you know, were coming. I did 10-day intensives there for people. And it, that was, in a way, the most of a center that I ever had.
Mm.
And that's where I did a lot of the sweat lodges and shamanic work as well.
I like the one where you're all painted. A wonderful, wonderful, vibrant picture, isn't it, where your body's all painted. Did you do that sort of celebration ceremony?
Well, a painted figure, I think that's somebody else.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was a body, a live, a person, a woman.
Hmm.
I thought it was you, but...
I'm not sure which picture. I don't think that I have a picture of me painted in this book. But...
Well, you know what? That doesn't matter. It's just the vibrance of this gathering of people.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the outlandish and symbolic presentations.
Well, I'll tell you, our intensives, and I still do give those,
mm-hmm.
are very rich and joyous, hilarious, deep. You know, there's a lot of humor and laughter, and yet, you know, it's very deep. There was a deaf woman once from Switzerland who was in my shamanic class. And she was deaf, and yet she was able to somehow to take this class because we communicated in ways that were not, you know, beyond the verbal.
Hmm.
Now, we also sang original songs. Now, that's very daring for people to do if they are not used to that. But in the shamanic classes, it became quite ordinary to sing a spontaneous original song just on the spur of the moment.
How
well,
wonderful.
This deaf woman sang the most incredible song, and she herself could not hear it.
Oh.
And I was just flabbergasted with that. That's one of, you know, the most poignant experiences.
That's a wonderful thing.
Because she came to be to that pitch of awareness that she wanted to sing, and she knew what we were doing, and she did. It was awesome.
Wow, isn't that wonderful?
Yes,
the exuberance of the spirit.
Yeah.
Rowena, we have like just a few minutes left, and I would like you to speak. You said you're already doing, you're still doing shamanic intensives. You're still doing...
Well, it's not always shamanic, but intensives in various ways, yes.
So how would people be in touch with you, and can you tell us what kind of intensive it would be?
Well, the best way is from my website to keep in touch. Right now, I'm attempting to sell my house in Dripping Springs here west of Austin mm-hmm. and move to New Mexico.
Why are you moving to New Mexico?
Well, it's just the next thing.
Hmm.
And but consequently, I'm not giving an intensive this year. And
mm-hmm.
besides, it's too hot here in the summer, and that's partly why I want to move. But I, when I was in Colorado, I had many intensives, and that was for 8 years
hmm.
in Crestone.
In Crestone.
And the next place is outside in the mountains outside of Albuquerque.
Hmm.
So I will have them there. But people need to check the www.creative-harmonics.org. And so any kind of intensives would be listed there.
Well, I know that when you're down at the in Santa Cruz, you're going to give a joint workshop with Randy Masters.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm actually giving a digital slideshow of a kind of cosmic new paradigm that I think will stimulate people to awaken more to the interconnections of everything. And instead of listening to all the bad news, there's so much in the universe that works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically sort of pointing out all of these different interconnections. For example, what I call the matrix is on the quantum level. I call it the plenum instead of the vacuum because it's full. Plenum means full.
Great.
And the fullness gives birth to everything, and that's essentially the love light. Well, the matrix occurs in our nervous system, mm-hmm. in nerve nets of all kinds, in memory. I'm just saying that there are patterns on multiple levels that are never taught in school, and that could give people a sense of wholeness and well-being on a much deeper level. So that's kind of my aim with that slideshow. And Randy is giving harmonic exercises after each segment of my slideshow.
I haven't talked to you much about music and harmonics and so on, and we don't have enough time now. But Randy is a sound healer, and you have so much in this wonderful book, which I will repeat the name of, The Golden Echo, The Life and Art of Rowena Patty Crider from 1935.
And I can get that on my website.
Oh, great.
Creative-harmonics.org.
Wonderful. And I really would like to have gotten into the music, but if we go to at least some of the workshop, we'll get into that, will we?
We'll see. I'm mainly giving this slideshow, and Randy will do what he does. I'm not necessarily facilitating harmonics in that particular. It's only one day.
That's right. Well, we wanted it all in 1 hour, for heaven's sake. You know, I've really enjoyed this, and you've just the book and even the cards.
Well, thank you, Veronica, and thank you for your good work with this process and awakening and communicating with more and more people.
Well, many blessings to you, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, that was our wonderful guest, and my gosh, her years have taken her through such an evocation of symbolism and a presentation of finding the essence of our being, and she's en route to bringing up more of a collective comprehension of this. I really recommend taking a look at her website, creative-harmonics.org, and her book, The Golden Echo. I really am enjoying what I've had time to read so far. If you'd like to be on my mailing list to find out what nurse coming up next week, email me. Or even if you just want to have a session, I do wonderful healing sessions, intuitive sessions, helping you find more about your soul journey. Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle.com. That's Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle.com. Or call me, 510-595-5564. And let's just pass on all that love and respect for one another. Much love to all of you. See you soon.